Let's Talk Letts, an original podcast from the Lettings Hub.
Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of our podcast, Let's Talk Letts. I'm Heidi Shackle, the CEO of the Lettings Hub, the tenant referencing business that got good at tech. Let's Talk Letts is our regular roundup of news and views on a whole range of subjects spanning the private rented sector. And in this episode, I'm really excited to be joined by Lucy Noonan, the founder of Atomic Consultancy, which is an acquisition management consultancy for the property industry. Now, Lucy has recently been described as a property industry veteran. And at only the age of 40, I'm not sure why, because she definitely brings a huge amount of energy. What she does is she provides support, practical advice and broker services to both lettings and estate agency businesses who are looking to grow via acquisition or those looking to sell. But without further ado, let me introduce you to Lucy. Thank you for obviously joining us today. Give us a bit of a brief introduction into you, your business and how you've ended up here 40 years on.
Oh, amazing. Thanks, Heidi. That is definitely an intro, isn't it? apparently I've been named a veteran, which I find really funny. But I have been in the industry since a week after my 16th birthday. I am 40 in May, so I suppose I have been in the industry a long time. Started a week after as a weekend negotiator working at Hunters Estate Agents. And then from there, was at Hunters for about 5 years. And then went into Countrywide onto their management development programme. So I've worked for both corporates, franchising, but for the last just over 10 years now, I've worked in acquisitions. So I was a buyer in the acquisitions team at LSL. And then I went to work at the Lohmann Group as their acquisitions director, which obviously a lot of people have seen a flurry of activity in the market. So I've done probably over, I think, 350 acquisitions now in that time. And then just over 2 years ago, decided to take the brave step because I could see that there was an opportunity in the market to not only just help agents to grow via acquisition. So they might need to just parachute me in terms of my knowledge and expertise and project manage a deal for them on their behalf and broker that deal, but also support sellers through that process and become a brokerage. Launched in October 21. So just over 2 years, and we've now completed on 76 acquisitions. Wow. Yeah, my business plan was 15 in the first year. So I've had to redo my business plan quite significantly.
do you already have plans of how you're going to celebrate number 100?
Well, we celebrated 50 with quite a unique video with PVS. I think a few people saw that. I haven't actually. So the first 50 actually was quite quick. And so the last kind of 24, we've started to enter into a slightly different market. So our original deal size was probably around 300,000 to 400,000. So they obviously have a quicker transaction time. And we're starting to break now the kind of 5+ million, which obviously they just take longer, but much better in terms of overall involvement and obviously fee as well. That's what I'm really excited about, because I think people have seen us potentially as the small to medium sized broker, but and actually we can do both. But I'm really passionate about helping supporting people regardless of their size. I think that's really important because it's their business and something that they're proud of, so they need to be dealt with in the respect that it deserves, really.
Yeah, well, congratulations to you, because that's been a fantastic nearly two and a half years kind of to get started. I obviously do follow you on social media and things, and the one thing I would say is you're so vibrant and you look like you have so much fun. How important is that in terms of your success so far? And obviously it's not just you, there's obviously you've grown a team now as well.
Yeah, I think it was interesting actually, because I was asked this a few weeks ago, and I've obviously worked for some of the major national companies, and one previous boss said to me if I was to be successful, I'd have to moderate my behaviour. And I really took that to heart. And I am vivacious. I have got a big personality. I put thumbs up in all of my photos, but I can be professional. I am professional and I understand, and I am an expert in acquisitions now. And I own that now. I used to find that quite difficult to say. But I do know what I'm doing, but that doesn't mean that I can't empathize and also enjoy what I'm doing. And it was interesting, that very individual that said that to me, he emailed me just one line and said, "You've proved me wrong." So I think it's a big lesson, actually, that you can be authentically yourself. And I think people have just got behind me as well. You know, I got made redundant and that was a part of the start of the journey. I've been really supported by so many people in the industry. We're offering something, you know, everyone will say something different, but I do genuinely believe that we are. You know, the people I've got in my team now have all worked in the acquisitions arena, and particularly in lettings. So we are human. We understand that it can be sometimes a very difficult decision that someone's reached to sell because of ill health or retirement or changing circumstances. So whilst getting the numbers and getting the right deal for them in terms of financials is key, actually it's probably the only time they'll ever do it.
So tell me a bit, I suppose, about, you know, your personality has become your brand personality, and then that's obviously attracted other people to join you. And how big is your team now? What's the kind of makeup? And have you got kind of very similar people, would you think?
Well, we're an all-female team, which wasn't intentional. But obviously, I am also a committee member of Women in Estate Agency. So I'm hugely passionate about supporting women in the industry to grow via their career and inspire them. Because I think when I started off, it certainly there wasn't anything like what there is now in terms of mentorships and you know, these groups that have now formed, which, you know, I've personally taken a lot out of. So there's a team of four of us now. We've all from the industry. Apart from one, we're all parents of young children, all under age 10. So, you know, I'm very much, you know, it's February half term this week. As an example, I'm not in the office. I've been out in the meetings today and then I've come home. So work-life balance and flexibility for the team is really important. But we absolutely love what we do. And you know, I've been... growing the right team has probably been the biggest challenge as a business owner, not gonna lie.
Yeah,
that has been really hard, but I feel now that we have got a really great team in place. I'm not sure right now. We were going to recruit somebody else, but I think finding the right people is so key to all businesses. And that's something that particularly we've seen a big shift in terms of the profit margins of businesses has reduced because people are having to bring in more expensive resource in terms of staff. And that has impacted sometimes the value of businesses. So I can empathise personally now as a business owner that building the right team is just so important. And if you get it wrong, it can have catastrophic effects, not just on the actual operational side of the business, but also on your profitability.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I personally love recruiting people, but I find it, you know, quite stressful sometimes when you're going through it, just thinking, I just want the right one to come along. And then when you find them, you know that you found them. And that's kind of definitely an all-time high. Okay, so let's kind of get into the nitty-gritty then of acquisitions and sales and everything, because I think it's actually something that all business owners have on their mind. And definitely in our industry, there's been a lot of comings and goings. There always seems to be an announcement of some portfolio that's moved or somebody that's kind of sold their lettings book or et cetera, et cetera. So obviously valuing a business and obviously what something is worth is always going to be a bit of a sensitive area, because what one person might perceive as valuable in their own business is quite different sometimes to what someone is prepared to pay for it. What would you say are the main key challenges that you come across, and what have you got any advice or tips for people?
Yeah, so it's really difficult because some of the things I'm probably about to say is we get challenged on a regular basis. And I'd love to be able to answer it differently, but factually, you know, the businesses that we've sold, we can see that, and obviously as a buyer previously. So a lot of agents that are strong market leaders in their local town have been established for, you know, 20 plus years. they believe that they have got a brand value and they in that area, and they do have you know, that that brand is important, but from a buyer's perspective, from an acquisitions perspective, the value of a brand is not seen probably or reflected as the same as a seller. And that can be quite a difficult thing for a seller to accept, yeah, because they've spent a fortune on marketing. You know, they've got the right move stats to show that they are market leaders. But from an acquisition perspective, unless you've got a branch network of six plus, from a buyer's perspective, they won't add any addition in terms of value to that brand.
I think as well, often, it's kind of sometimes family name, isn't it, as well?
Yes.
So there's the emotional attachment more than the actual value attachment, maybe.
Yeah. And also as well, it does affect potentially. So most buyers at the moment in the market won't pay 100% of the purchase price up front. They'll defer an element for a period of time. And so some sellers will say, well, they've chosen this brand to acquire, you know, to offer the services for them. If it changes brand, that could affect that deferred consideration. So then that's where, in terms of our brokering, we would advise and make sure that there's enough protection in there to ensure if it does change in terms of brand name, that that is protected to a certain extent. But I think that's probably probably one of the questions I get a lot asked, and probably secondly, the main thing. And again, if it could change, it would be brilliant, because we'd be able to sell a lot more. Is the value of estate agency businesses in comparison to lettings is just completely different. So the value of a business, both EA and lettings at the moment, is it's based on your guaranteed residual income that comes from management and rent collect. So that consistent monthly income that you get, that is where the golden ticket is. That is what buyers are wanting to acquire, and they're wanting to ensure that those landlords are entered into a long-term contract that they're going to get consistent income from. So the let only and other incomes that is generated from that portfolio, there is a value to it, but not half as much as that guaranteed residual. And unfortunately, sales, because we've had the peaks and troughs, buyers don't like that. Funders don't like the highs of 2021, where everybody's turnover spiked. Then we've had a difficult year last year. So it's not necessarily that buyers won't pay it, it's that the funders, the banks, don't like to see this, because they think potentially if we lend to that buyer, they might not be able to pay for it if it drops as much as it is. So again, it does change slightly if they've got, you know, over 1.1 to 1.5 million consistent turnover in sales. They can be an earnout agreed on that. But normally it's just basically based on the pipeline. So in a percentage of their SSTC pipeline and 20 and their instruction register. And that's it. And that can be really difficult for some agents, because they could have 70% of their turnover could be sales, and they consistently turn over 600,000. And then I'm telling them that actually it's probably only worth about 200 grand. And for them, that's very difficult. But unfortunately, buyers aren't attracted, because it's just a one fee income shot and that's it. And it can change quite a lot.
Well, I suppose, you know, there's the risk, isn't there? But they've also got to be able to fund it to make the purchase. And if they haven't got the backing of that, that kind of causes a problem. So let's kind of look forward then, because ultimately, for any business owner, I guess they're going to want to consider what their exit might be, particularly if they're approaching retirement or another kind of big life-changing event. So let's look forward in terms of like a five-year plan, a three-year plan, and a one-year. Let's say if somebody was thinking, oh, I might want to sell my business in 5 years or 3 years or one, what advice would you give them to kind of get their business in order? And what metrics, I suppose, should they focus on the most to try and get the most value at the end of that time?
Yeah, no, so really good question. So I think from a five-year, I personally say to sellers, regardless of sellers or buyers, you should always be looking at your exit plan, even if it's in 15 years' time. You know, being quite short-sighted and just looking at it a year before you're about to do it, or even sometimes a lot of our clients have literally just decided to retire and not even ever looked at working on the business before. I think the main thing I would recommend is they need to look at the structure of their business and how is it structured. So are you a limited company? Are you a partnership? Are you a sole trader? Making sure that your structure is correct is so key, and getting right tax advice right at an early outset. So, you know, looking at your turnover, and like I've said, in terms of sales and lettings, what a lot of businesses that we're consulting with at the moment are structuring the business where they have separate limited company underneath a holding company. So then in effect, the lettings business that is valued more is in a separate limited company, and then you can still sell that as a share sale, which benefits from currently less tax risks, as it were, compared to if you sell it as an asset. So structuring and making sure, so if you do new homes, if you've got financial services, potentially looking at separating all of those out so that you've got different options, because, for example, financial services, there's different buyers that would buy that FS. If you've got one company and everything is in there, so at the moment we're selling a company that's got lettings, agricultural, commercial, new homes, financial services, selling that whole business as a limited company is actually quite challenging because there isn't that many buyers that want to buy it all. Whereas if they'd actually hived a lot of that off and created separate companies, that would have been a lot easier in order to transfer. And also then you can sell different parts of the business at different times.
Yeah, or to different people. Yeah.
So definitely getting the structure right. And then my next thing would really be working with an accountant that really understands what you're doing. So making sure your accounts make sense. So just having a top line saying turnover, that's not helpful. You know, getting your management accounts in order. What is your managed income? What is your let only? What are all the other fees? And making sure you're working with an accountant that is gearing you up for sale. We see so many businesses. So we had one just last week that the accountant included VAT in their turnover figure. And actually that completely reduced their profit by 20% because it wasn't income, that's VAT. No. So, you know, again, getting a really good accountant and tax advice right at an early outset and making sure you're structuring, I think, is from a long-term perspective an exit strategy. And then when you're coming to about a year, I would advise people getting reverse due diligence done on the business. So getting an internal audit done, you can have them. There's some great companies out there that will come and do an on-site day visit with you, making sure your client account reconciles, making sure, you know, your operational due diligence is there. So, you know, have you got, you know, all of your terms of business? Is it easy to locate? You know, are you doing all the right legislative requirements that are needed now? But really, to be honest, it's all about numbers. Do you know your numbers, and are they all reconciling, and can you present it? If we can have a business that's got excellent management accounts that backs up their statutory accounts, that then just presents their business in a much, much better light.
Yeah, I actually wrote that down as you were talking in terms of present the business in terms of management information and statistics. I understand financial statistics become really important in terms of valuation, but it's, I suppose, sometimes it's what's the underlying story. Is that business growing? Is that business in decline? How is that business performing in its local market? What is its retention rates, I suppose, of landlords? How much does all of those kind of, I suppose, key indicators factor in terms of what a buyer would question early on in that process?
Yeah, you can have a turnover of over £1 million, but not make any money, not make any profit. And that's the other thing as well, is you focusing on the turnover. But we've seen that's probably the biggest shift I've seen in the last 4 years is the breakdown of costs in comparison to what it was, say, 5 years ago. So traditionally, as a buyer, you really only want 50% of your overall turnover costs to be staff. And we're seeing that now at some businesses at like 80%. So whilst you can drive economies of scale through acquiring a portfolio and potentially not needing as many staff that the previous owner had, reducing your costs is really key. So don't sign up to, if you're looking to exit in the next 5 years, don't sign up to a 10-year lease on your premises. You know, if you're about to negotiate another contract with your CRM provider or whoever, don't agree to 10 years. The key ones really are printers and phones. They have horrendous commercial terms, some for like 15 years. Well, actually, whilst it looks it's cheap over a month, that buyer that's come back might have to take on a 10-year contract and they might not want to do that.
So I guess, you know, thinking about anything that kind of may become not attractive to a buyer on the basis that we don't know who that buyer might be, such as long-term supplier contracts, as you mentioned, obviously CRM, because they may obviously bin the brand, mightn't they? They might close the office. They may make redundancies to your people. So keeping all the options open, I guess, is pretty key.
Yeah, definitely. And this isn't a plug, by the way, to you guys or prop tech companies in itself, but it baffles me that we saw a business the other week and they had three CRM providers. Wow. Because they used one for property management, one for client accounting, and one for registering tenancies. And I know these three CRMs do all of that, and they're spending a huge amount of money. And they had a referencing administrator, but they were using your service. And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, if you get your suppliers in and get yourself properly trained and use tech, that is going to reduce your cost. So they get all of these great products. And there are brilliant products out there, but they're just not using them. And then that actually is increasing their administrative costs in terms of staff. And, you know, they're paying, you know, three CRM providers every month that one system could do. So I do think it's, you know, that is really key as well, is getting the best out of the suppliers that you've got. And basically sitting down and having a hit list of what is important to you as a business owner, what do you absolutely critically need from your CRM provider, and make that list, because every business owner has a different criteria to them, and you know that there is systems out there that will hit that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess going back to what you said before, having that internal audit or someone to come and kind of do a quick due diligence exercise, that those people that can do that are really good at saying, you know, when we're comparing to others, you're paying a huge amount in system fees. So you probably want to look at that. So actually, it's a really good business kind of, I suppose, MOT anyway, just doing that now and again, isn't it, in terms of a consultancy?
Definitely.
I guess another thing is I suppose a buyer's looking for resilience. Go back to what you were saying before in different markets, which is why I guess the lettings portfolios are valued higher than a state agency. How much does that affect valuations, I suppose, in terms of how many products a landlord's buying, what type of service they're connected to? Have they got, you know, are they buying things like, you know, rent and legal protection on top of their management fee, or have they got the premier service? How does that kind of work through in terms of the calculations?
So key is to keep it simple. And particularly for London agents is making sure that your monthly income is residual. So it's coming in every month. So we see a lot of London agents that will let a property for 18 months and they take up the whole fee at that first 1 or 2 months. Well, that's then going to have to be apportioned to a new buyer because they're not going to take on a fee earning property for free for a year. In terms of the services that you provide, as long as we can easily extrapolate the costs that you've associated with rent and legal protection is a perfect example, looking at what your contractor commission is, as long as that is evidenced in your P&L and your management accounts, and then we can see the fixed cost of what that insurance product was, we can then work that out. If you've got rent collect at the moment, trying to move them to a managed service and again for let only, moving let only as much as you can into a rent collect service because that's where it's guaranteed. London are slightly different as well because their let only is sometimes they do have a renewal clause in there, so it actually becomes contractual. So London, you can get you can achieve a higher value for just let only. It's disappointing that the rest of the country don't do that. We do see a lot of businesses that just have a good solid let only portfolio, particularly student, but it's just let only. And the concern for buyers there is the churn happening every year, and that's why there's a lower kind of multiplier applied on let only. So it key is you want consistency of that income coming in every single month.
Yeah, and we've discussed actually in a couple of the latest podcasts, we did one with Megan 18, obviously the queen of TikTok, and Chris Watkins. Actually, one of the key themes that came out was obviously how lettings businesses attract more landlords so that they're constantly growing their portfolio, and then obviously how they get them on the managed service. Now, we know it's not easy, which is why I guess some letting agents may decide to grow their business through acquisition. What are the good reasons for doing it as an agent? You know, how do you, and actually, how do you do it? Because if you've operated in the same town as somebody for 20 years And actually, you know, enough of the competitors, sometimes enemies, I would go as far to say, you know, how do you make that approach? Or is that really why using a third party like yourself becomes actually really key to kind of be that middle man or lady?
Yeah, so growing via acquisition for many independent agents is the fastest way to grow. You're taking out your competitor. You can it's a quick return on your investment. So you add in profit down onto your bottom line immediately. You know, there's less risk involved in other ways in which you can organically grow via acquisition. And also it's the easiest probably way to enter into a new territory. So we're seeing a lot of independent agents, particularly that, say, for example, are based, I don't know, in York, and actually they want to launch in Harrogate and they're buying a portfolio in Harrogate. So it's not a cold start. Cold starts are really, really challenging. So again, opening into a new territory via acquisition is a really great way in order to grow. In terms of how to approach businesses, is I see a lot of buyers that don't use an intermediary or have approached direct, is pay the market value. So don't try and undercut. Because these sellers are savvy and they will come to someone like myself and will say, well, actually, it's worth 300,000 and this person's only offered me two. So I don't mind saying I've got a huge amount of respect for my very last boss, which was Will Lindley at Lindley & Simpson. Absolutely think Will is amazing. And Lindley & Simpson grew amazingly quickly through acquisition. And Will is basically known as the acquisition king of Yorkshire. I think out of the ones we've done, I think we've only done four or five in Yorkshire. And the reason being is Will has done the long game. He is well respected in his area. He pays the market value. He doesn't pull out of deals unless there's a real critical issue. And so, you know, he has been well regarded. I see a lot of buyers at the moment trying to do things clever, different ways in which, and it just won't work. And, you know, we do offer, we're the only broker as well that offers a project management service for buyers. So we can look at businesses and say, look, this is what I think it's worth, how you would structure it as an earnout. There's lots of different ways in which you can acquire a business. Funding's a big challenge for some buyers. But I think just being, it sounds silly, but being honest and credible and respectful to that business owner. We've got sellers that come to us, and we always say before we launch, is there anybody that you don't want us to approach? And that's a really interesting question, because a lot of sellers will say, I don't want to touch them with a barge pole, because they have attacked my portfolio, they've stolen my marketing, they've done all of this. And naturally, like you mentioned earlier, you know, some of them have become enemies. And I just think, you know, there's competition in what I do, but I would never be derogatory to my competitors. And I think as letting agents, we're quite bad at that. And actually, when it does come to exit, that person that you potentially might have been really aggressive and rude to, they've got a choice. You know, it is a seller's market. It isn't a buyer's market at the minute.
Yeah. And I suppose in that scenario, if that brand, that business has been trying to attack your portfolio and copy your marketing, they obviously see value in you, you know, your business. So actually they're the perfect ones to actually potentially even pay slightly more for it.
Yeah, well, we completed on one last week and I just announced it. I think it was yesterday. And one particular buyer rang me that registered with me and he got really aggressive. He was like, I would have bought that. That's perfect for me. I said, I know. I said, but they wouldn't allow me to approach you. And he said, why? And I said the conversation and he went, well, yeah, that's true. I says, well, you lost out because you were unprofessional. Yeah. And that seller didn't forget it.
It's a small industry, isn't it, really? Like, you know, like you described at the beginning, the different brands that you've worked with and that, you know, you have a great relationship with. But that's so evident in our industry and the people move around. So, yeah, things don't get forgotten, definitely. So what percentage of deals complete versus why do they fall through? And if they fall through, what are the common reasons? And can you kind of foresee some of them sometimes?
Yeah, so it's interesting, really. I'd say the smaller deals, so deals under 500,000, I'd say very few fall through. Deals of larger scale, there's more complexities with it. The main reasons why deals will fall through is holes in the client account, there's issues with compliance. That's probably the biggest area of concern. And probably one of the biggest changes in the last year has been funding. So a buyer potentially has got funding in place, proof of funds, but it's very different from buying a house where you get a decision in principle, you know, you get that certificate. In commercial lending, that they will only look at it once a deal's been agreed. So they might have something in principle, but then a buyer might need to take personal security, take a debenture out, etc. And they maybe go, do you know what? I don't want to do that. So we are seeing at the moment, particularly for independent buyers, funding being a real challenge, which is why some of the larger organisations that have got cash and don't have that issue are being more successful at the moment. So I'd say numbers, finance and funding is probably the biggest issues. But we're basically like an estate agent selling estate agents. That's what I am. That's what we do. So it's really difficult to say what percentage of deals fall through. We probably, on average, we launch about 5 or 6 businesses a month for sale, and then 3 to 4 complete a month.
And how long does the process take? Let's kind of take it at the smaller business end and then the top. Like, what's the difference in timeline?
So I think people get really shocked by this, because they think it's going to be a 9 to 12 month process, and it isn't. So assets, the portfolios, you can do in 4 weeks, and it can be that quick. Mm-hmm. Particularly if it's a well-run portfolio, there's no premises and limited terms of staff numbers, etc. On a share sale, you're probably looking at about 12 to 15 weeks at the moment. That's probably the average. Larger transactions that have got, you know, several premises and things involved probably be about 6 months. And the thing is I really believe you've only got one shot to maximise the value of your business. It's like a house sale. If it keeps going up for sale and coming back down, it's not as attractive. So we always say to sellers, you've got to be 100% committed that you want to sell, because as soon as I launch it, we do a 3-week marketing campaign, we drive value and we get a deal for you, and then we go into legals. So it has to be the right time for sellers to exit. They can't just tentatively think, oh, well, I want to sell in March 2025, which I had someone last week. I said, well, contact me in December this year. Yeah. Because yeah, there's no point me trying to agree a deal, because this year in particular, is there's so much happening. We've got the general election, capital gains tax could change, you know, interest rates. You know, a year is just very different in the acquisition space, like house sales as well, isn't it? You know, So you can't agree a deal now and expect it to be the same this time in 12 months, because probably it won't be.
And I suppose is like one of the questions people might have is, using a consultancy service like yourself obviously is going to cost money, and that will come out of the proceeds of sale, I guess, or whatever deal is structured. Does that cost often kind of get negated in the fact that you're obviously able to, A, make sure that deal completes in most cases, and also kind of drive the highest value?
Obviously, I'm going to say yes. But there's facts behind it. You know, it astounds me sometimes that letting agents and estate agents do this, because you sit in front of landlords and vendors on a daily basis saying, why use an agent that can drive value on your price? Why would you wouldn't suggest selling your house privately to somebody else without having a full marketing campaign? And obviously my job is to drive value. We've got over 7,000 registered buyers, and even if a buyer has already approached you, if they know that there's a competitive bidding process, they are going to sharpen the pencil. But it's not just about getting the overall price. It's making sure, is the deal structured correctly? Are the terms right? What's your earn out? What's your deferred consideration? And what, as that buyer, what is their due diligence process like? So it's not just focusing on a multiple or the overall price. It's the whole thing. But we just sold one in Westminster, and he had a buyer that had approached him direct. We launched it to market, and that buyer is still buying it, but he's buying it at 75 grand more than what he did before.
Yeah.
So, because the Noonan got involved.
Yeah.
Which he says now, he wish I hadn't. But I knew that he could get more for it, and he did.
And what about talking to staff? I guess that's the other thing, in terms of when in the process, is that a good idea, a bad idea? Is it, you know, do employees get to know after the deal is done?
Yeah, so this is probably the hardest thing that a lot of sellers find is really challenging. And we have a thing in the office where we say the seller, it's called seller's remorse. And it normally happens about a week before completion or a few days before, because they've been so focused on everything. And then it gets to the point where they know they're going to, everyone's going to find out. And it's really daunting and quite stressful, and it's really emotional. But these sellers, you as a seller, or as a, you've entered into an NDA, a confidentiality agreement, so legally you can't speak. And also, it's very, I actually think it's very unfair of a seller to inform their staff before it's completed, because the deal might not happen, and then you've put that staff member in a really difficult situation. They'll have questions that they'll want to ask the employer, their new employer, and that employer can't speak to them until completion for legal reasons. So they're left in a really vulnerable place and at risk of leaving because they panic. Whereas if it's done correctly and it's done, you know, at completion, yes, it is probably the hardest thing that a seller has to do, particularly if it isn't for retirement. But, you know, that most of the buyers in our industry at the moment that are buying, you know, the most biggest challenge is good staff. So I think a lot of people panic that they're going to have loads of redundancies, but actually that, you know, it's difficult to recruit as it is. So there's only very few roles that are at main risk of redundancy on every acquisition, you know, but property managers, good salespeople, those buyers want them, you know, they're buying them as well as the portfolio.
Well, we're a people business, aren't we? You know, and so therefore people are such a key part of businesses that I can understand why they are. And exactly to your point, you know, that seller is at risk of losing their staff, especially if a deal doesn't go through. They're then in a really kind of awful position, which kind of puts them and their business at risk in a fairly depressing position, I'm sure.
Yeah, when I was at Countrywide, when I was 21, there was an acquisition. So I was Bairstow Eaves one day, and then literally at 9 o'clock in the morning, some guys in black suits came in and said, "You're now Renton's Countrywide." And I was like, I mean, I didn't even know at that point what an acquisition was. And I remember thinking, holy mother of pearl, what, like, I've now got to answer. It wasn't, there was no kind of, you know, welcome or change or anything else. It was like, no, we've acquired, that's it. It's Conan to the Countrywide brand and that's it. So I know how it feels. You know, I've had people throw up on me when I've gone in because they've been so nervous. But, you know, you can, as an employee of an acquisition, you can take it both ways. And actually, you, the buyer that's bought the business is wanting to grow. So there's huge amounts of opportunity for you. And I think sometimes people can be quite narrow-minded to think that, you know, oh, well, I'm going to hate it. I always say to people, give it 6 months. So that person that was sick on me was an acquisition I did about 8 years ago in Darlington. She walked out, said she couldn't cope, and she's still there now. Loves it.
Yeah. I was going to say, most of the time, good things happen, don't they? It's not like it's bad. Okay, well, I am all out of questions. That was so interesting. I was making lots of kind of notes as we were going through, because I think there's loads of tips in there just for businesses to think about in the day to day and to really kind of think about what their plan is for the future. So thank you very much for all your time and all your advice. Before you go, Lucy, and complete on your next deal, our regular listeners of Let's Talk Let's will know that we always end every pod with a funny story or anecdote from our guests. Now, I'm sure you might have many, but can you give us some of your best?
Oh, God. I think earlier in my career, I learned don't judge a book by its cover. So I think that's quite prominent for me, because people, I think, judge me for being this vivacious person. But I can be a strong negotiator. And I was 19 years old. I mean, I look back now and just think, what the hell are hunters doing? But I was 19. They gave me a mini and they put me up in Manchester. I was from a tiny village in Yorkshire, outside of York. And they put me on Deansgate in Manchester. I was literally loving life. And this chap came in to view an apartment, and people had said, you know, there's professional footballers and all sorts of Coronation Street and people that live in this block. So you've got to be careful because you think that they might be just wanting to see that it's where Ryan Giggs lives. This guy comes in, and for a start, he had a La Senza lingerie bag with him. So he was wanting to view. And at this time, we're going 20 years ago, it was over £1 million. So, you know, I was thinking, if you're buying La Senza and you're buying a, at least agent provocateur, isn't it? Let's be honest. So I took one look at this guy and was like, you can't afford this apartment. So anyway, all the people at Hunters moved back, because at this point I'm completely oblivious. Start taking those debt. Anyway, it was Gary Neville. I had no idea.
Oh, wow.
And then I had to show him around this apartment. And it gets even worse, though, because halfway round, I says, oh, my brother really loves Man U. And he says, oh, would you like my autograph? And I went, no, would you like mine?
Did he take it well, though?
No.
Oh, no, he's not a good sport, really.
I'm not into all of that. And I just was like, oh, no, I don't need your autograph. I'm trying to be polite. I was like, oh, you can have mine. Yeah. But obviously, it was because he was famous and I wasn't famous and I'm not famous. So, yeah. But, you know, I genuinely judged him, thinking he's got no money, he can't buy this house. But actually, yeah, he probably could, and probably bought the whole block if he wanted to. Yeah,
10 times over. Thank you so much, and an amazing story. To ensure our listeners don't miss an episode of Let's Talk Let's, please make sure you all follow us on Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcast. Please leave us a review if you like what you hear. And thank you all very much for listening.
Let's Talk Let's, an original podcast from the Lettings Hub.